and open up a continuation of public hearing on Senate Bill 838. We have a lot of people that would like to testify today. I have my trusty timer here, so we're going to keep to the three-minute time as we did before. So just so you guys know, we really do have a timer. We're not making this up. And I would like to thank everybody who came from far away, and we're going to try to make sure and get you up first.
Madam Chair, a quick question. I do have, I've been doing my homework since the last hearing, and I've got a few follow-up questions I'd like to ask somebody from the Utility Commission if that would be possible. I don't see anybody here today, but...
Okay. Well, we can try to get them here by the end of the hearing.
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you. And I don't know where the rest of my committee is, but they'll be here, I'm sure, eventually. With that, I'm going to call up the folks who came from over 100 miles first, and that I'm going to call you up, actually, if all three of you can come up together. Stuart Leibowitz, Holly Sterling, and Wayne Estes. And again, you'll have 3 minutes maximum each, and if you can state your name for the record. If you have any handouts for the committee, you can provide those to Ian, and he'll make sure that we get them.
My name is Stuart Leibowitz. I'm from Roseburg, Oregon. I'm with the Douglas County Global Warming Coalition. The Douglas County Global Warming Coalition strongly supports SB 838, which would create a renewable energy standard for the state of Oregon. As a grassroots organization that has worked on this critical issue of global warming for over 4 years, we believe this bill represents a significant step forward in finding a solution to the climate crisis. The recent report issued by the International Panel on Climate Change has made it clear that we must act with a sense of urgency to ensure the livability of the planet for future generations. By joining 20 other states across America in this effort, Oregon will be able to take advantage of the emerging technologies that exist and are being developed to resolve this problem. Global warming presents both a challenge and an opportunity. Our generation has a moral imperative to do what is necessary to leave a future in which our children will not bear the burden of the devastating consequences of global warming. Our window of opportunity is closing fast. The time to act is now. By ensuring that 25% of our electricity is produced by clean, renewable energy by 2025, we will have the opportunity to take advantage of the economic benefits these renewable resources will offer in the 21st century. According to the report of the International Panel on Climate Change, potential economic and human consequences will be unprecedented both globally and locally. Around the world, temperatures may increase over the next century by nearly 8 degrees, with sea levels rising to 2 feet. If the economic repercussions of such a change in our planet seem incalculable, how much more so the human consequences? Population displacement, drought, and deaths from heat waves will face future generations unless we act today. Information just released from the upcoming second installment of the IPCC's report stated that hundreds of millions of people throughout the world will be short of water in 20 years, and with this, death rates from malaria, dengue fever, and malnutrition will rise. Nor will Oregon be immune from the consequences of global warming. In the Northwest, diminished snowpacks and droughts will significantly impact timber, wine, skiing, and tourist industries. For the Douglas County Global Warming Coalition, our concerns go beyond just the economic. We believe we are morally and ethically bound to look our children in the eye and tell them we did all we could to stop global warming. This bill, SB 838, represents such a statement to our children.
Thank you. Excellent job, and you've got 43 seconds left over. Thanks for coming today. We appreciate it. Why don't you go ahead?
Yes, I'm Polly Sterling. I'm also a member of the Douglas County Global Warming Coalition. The consensus is really clear right now that we need to act on global warming. This has been endorsed by both public entities and corporations, this understanding that standards are necessary if we are to really have an impact. Oregon is poised with Senate Bill 838 to join several other states and corporations which are working to address this issue. With this legislation, Oregon will be able to put into place a long-term commitment to clean, renewable energy. This means we will not only be reducing CO2 emissions in the near future, but we will also be making renewable energy the economic foundation of our state. Personally, I cannot say too much about this, about the importance of this. It is absolutely essential that we begin addressing this problem right now. I encourage all of you to give your consideration to approving this legislation. Thank you.
Great, thank you.
My name is Wayne Estes. I'm a resident of Oakland in Douglas County, Oregon. And I just want to voice my strong support for SB 838. I feel like this bill will really give Oregon, the state of Oregon, more control over its long-term economic destiny. It will create jobs in Oregon that will basically be displacing money that is leaving the state now to purchase coal and natural gas from elsewhere, and will take a portion of that money that's leaving the state currently and invest it in Oregon and renewable energy to create jobs in Oregon. And also, it can create a virtuous cycle of both improving the economy, improving the environment, which is good for the public health of the citizens of Oregon. And in the long term, investments in renewable energy gives us control over the price of our energy, because the renewable energies have a relatively stable long-term cost relative to other sources that are imported, and those supplies have been increasing dramatically in cost and are likely to continue to increase in cost. So again, you know, it's hard to put a dollar amount on the benefit of the improved public health for Oregon citizens, but I feel this bill really does create a virtual cycle that reinforces, improves the Oregon economy, jobs for Oregon, and public health for Oregon. I really think it's a win-win situation for everybody.
Thank you. Appreciate you coming here today all the way from Douglas County as well. Are there any questions for this panel? Thank you very much for your input. Okay, next, I'm going to call up some other folks who have come from far away. We have Judge Laura Pryor. Good to see you, as always. And I'm going to also call up Eric Peterson from PV Powered and Sylvia Hayes, 3E Strategies, our Bend contingent. Are they here?
I haven't seen Sylvia.
Okay. Well, we're waiting for Sylvia. What about Eric? Is Eric out here as well? Okay. Why don't you go ahead, Judge? Nice to see you, as always. Thanks
Thank
for coming.
Chairman Steve Felder, Vice Chair Burley, members of the committee, thank you for having me here. I am representing the Eastern Oregon Rural Alliance, and I'll be very brief. The capitalist system needs markets to be able to operate, and this is one of the few things that rural Oregon has seen in a very long time that makes a lot of sense. And it fits not only with the geography and the winds, thank God, for wind towers, but it also fits with the communities. It doesn't make a huge adverse impact on the communities, but it's a great benefit. And I'm going to ask you, please, this is something you could do to be able to kickstart this and give it a good foundation so that Oregon can have it. It really fits our way of life. And I want to encourage you, please consider this. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions for the judge? I would like to say that we appreciate your input, because we've heard on Monday from a lot of folks from the eastern part of the state, and certainly I do believe that this is a bill that could have a very positive impact on your part of the state that's been hard hit in the past. So I appreciate you sharing your thoughts with us.
Thank you, Madam Chair, very much.
Any other questions or comments? Okay. No. All right, so we'll move on then, and hopefully we can find them, because I'm assuming they were here if they signed up, unless they did it in absentia. So next I will call up, we have some folks who are left over from Monday that didn't get to testify, so we'll start with them, and then we'll move on to the rest of the sign-up sheet. Scott Winkles from the League of Oregon Cities, Maui Meyer, who's here with Hood River County, and John Arends. Okay.
Good afternoon, Chair Dingfelder and Vice Chair Burley and members of the committee. My name is Maui Meyer. I'm a Hood River County Commissioner, and I'll be presenting on behalf of the Association of Oregon Counties and Hood River County.
Great. Thank you. Welcome.
First, the Association of Oregon Counties. This is from Bobby Green. The Association of Oregon Counties supports the renewable energy policies being addressed in Senate Bill 838A. AOC worked with an inclusive group of public and private sector stakeholders convened by Governor Kulongowski over a year ago into what was called the Renewable Energy Work Group. The group was capably supported by staff of the Oregon Department of Energy. Members studied the issues, brought in outside expertise, deliberated over which major public policy changes should be recommended to the legislature to address Oregon's cumulative reliance on fossil fuels for electricity generation. Early in the process, the membership began developing a set of policy recommendations that would increase our development and use of renewable energy and seek to build a robust renewable energy industry in Oregon. Your House Committee on Energy and the Environment has received from the Senate further refined recommendations of the Renewable Energy Work Group, negotiated among many affected parties. This is an excellent bill. You will receive enthusiastic testimony from all over the state of Oregon for legislative recognition that development of small community projects as well as larger scale efforts throughout rural Oregon would be a positive accomplishment. Some projects are now in development, but to capture a vital renewable energy industry in Oregon, there needs to be certainty of market. To make that happen, the Oregon legislature should expect large and small utilities to increase their use of renewable sources in serving Oregon consumers. Establishing an RPS, along with improved incentives and a greater commitment to research and development, such as wave energy, will complete the 2000 package. A number of surrounding states have already established renewable energy standards, and Oregon is behind in claiming that we see a future where renewable energy can grow and prosper. By setting our own standards now, we can build the momentum for development of a clean, renewable energy industry and keep that revenue and increase tax base here for Oregon businesses and communities. This is a real opportunity for Oregon. AOC encourages you to make the timely policy choice now by supporting Senate Bill 838A. And briefly, on behalf of Hood River County, in addition to the endorsement by President Green of the AOC, I would, as a Hood River County Commissioner, like to add a few comments. I'm certain that much has been made of energy infrastructure issues and emerging market and the plain common sense of renewable energy in this day and age, but I'd like to bring to you a perspective of our small county, Hood River. At our level, the RPS is quite simply creates a level of hope. It gives us a sense that we might have a bit more control over our future, our direction, and ourselves. For the last 18 months, Hood River County has been researching transmission, siting, project potential, and partnerships in developing our own renewable energy generation infrastructure. We have projects identified and are working today towards making them real. The RPS creates our marketplace. This initiative has generated excitement. Local people are involved at each level. An incredible steering committee made up of irrigation districts, units of government, private individuals from all sectors of the economy are involved and excited to make a difference. No one wants to be left behind as these projects come together. The projects will generate revenue, jobs, and most of all, potential in our community. To us, this is a very Hood River thing to do. I submitted testimony during the Senate hearings that I'm submitting here in writing that this could be the largest untapped resource that Oregon has left. And as time progresses, I personally believe this more and more. This is one of the single greatest assets in Oregon, and it exists almost exclusively in rural Oregon. Once discussed in this context, it can become of great interest to many rural legislators. A chance to install an entirely new industry that is resource-based, in-county, technologically advanced, and most of all, mindful of that which is Oregon's ethos and Oregon's future. Hood River County strongly supports Senate Bill 838A and urges you to do the same.
Great. Thank you.
Thank you.
And just for the record, I'm a recovered windsurfer, so I keep thinking I'm going to pick up the sport again every time I come over and feel that wind blowing. So
we'll be there for you when you decide to.
Thank you.
Now you've got a new beach.
You do? Chair Dingfelder, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Scott Winkles with the League of Oregon Cities, representing the 242 incorporated cities in Oregon. Last year, the LOC set out parameters that needed to be met before we could support a renewable power standard. I'm pleased to inform the committee that those parameters have been met, and the League will gladly added support to the passage of Senate Bill 838.
The first criteria we looked for in an RPS was that it be a positive market influence. Over the last decade, 90% of the power plants built in the United States have been natural gas fueled. Because of this, electricity markets have been heavily influenced by natural gas pricing. This is concerning as the Energy Information Agency, which is a division of the U.S. Department of Energy, has projected a decrease in North American natural gas production and an increase from imported sources. These market developments do not bode well for electricity prices in the future, and introducing stabilizing renewable energy sources into the power supply would clearly be beneficial. The second criteria we looked at in determining our position on this legislation was that the RPS have cost protections built into it to protect customers from unanticipated price hikes. The cost cap contained in Section 12 gives us that protection. The next thing we looked at were the elements of local control. Initially, this was a significant hurdle for us, as early discussions did not include much in the way of local flexibility. With the addition of the alternative compliance payment in Sections 20 and 20A, we feel that this gives local communities the flexibilities to implement this measure in a manner that meets the needs of Oregon as a whole, not as a one-size-fits-all approach. Additionally, the ACP also protects ratepayers by allowing public and private utilities to delay investment in new energy sources if no prudent option exists at the time. The ACP further allows the utility to meet its obligations by investing in conservation and efficiency programs, but again, only if no prudent renewable energy investment is available at the time. The addition of the ACP was a significant component in our decision to support. In conclusion, Oregon cities have been innovators in energy efficiency and renewable resources. It was a city that built the first gold-rated green building in the state of Oregon. A city is working to install solar panels in all of their public buildings as we speak, and the League of Oregon Cities is working diligently with a group of investors to establish one of the first, if not the first, wastewater biosolids to energy plants in the country. My intention in pointing this out is not to boast, but to demonstrate that we understand that our shared constituents desire to reduce their environmental footprint and be insulated from a capricious energy market.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, Chair Dingfelder and members of the committee. For the record, my name is John Arns. I'm the Executive Director of Mid-Columbia Council of Governments. We provide services in a five-county area, Hood River, Wasco, Sherman, Gillum, and Wheeler counties, and I have been involved with community-based renewable energy projects in our region for a little bit over 2 years now. And I just came here to offer my support to Senate Bill 838A and ask for your support to continue to provide and encourage all the residents of Oregon to continue to build out renewable energy in our state. It's a great opportunity for local governments. It's a great opportunity for the citizens of Oregon, and it's a proactive way that you can help us all get to that goal. So thank you.
Okay, thank you. Thank you, gentlemen. Are there any questions for this panel? Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Next up, I don't know if did Eric Peterson or Sylvia Hayes show up? Okay. We'll keep working down the list. We had from last time Mike Sullivan, Kevin Lynch, and Jim Welsh. Okay, that was easy.
Wow. Well, here's my son.
Yeah. Welcome, gentlemen, and you're in 3 minutes.
Want me to go?
Whoever wants to go first.
Sure, I'll go first. Thank you for the opportunity to testify, Chair Dingfelder and members of the committee. My name is Kevin Lynch. I work for PPM Energy, which is the country's second largest developer of wind energy, and we're headquartered in Portland, Oregon. We have about 200 employees here in Oregon, and I'm here on their behalf to testify in support of Senate Bill 838A. About a third of our business is here in the Pacific Northwest. We've had a hand in approximately 500 megawatts of wind generation in the state of Oregon, including the Klondike projects, State Line, and the Leaning Juniper project. I was at our Klondike 3 project last Friday, which is a 221-megawatt capacity project under construction right now. That's an investment of about $350 million or thereabouts in Sherman County, Oregon. Klondike 3 is creating over 100 jobs in the area. It is contributing about $5 million in goods and services locally. And once it's operating, it'll pay in a rough order of magnitude in the high six figures to Sherman County in taxes and fees for well over a decade, closer to two. So these projects, Klondike 3 is not atypical of a wind development project of this size and scope in the Northwest these days. They're bringing good-paying jobs to the economy, buying services, and adding to the tax bases in the counties in rural Oregon where they're being developed. Senate Bill 838A will result in more investments like Klondike 3. States like Texas and Colorado and Minnesota, where we're also developing a lot of wind energy, that have RPS laws are attracting substantial investment, not just ours, but that of other companies. And in fact, all three of those states have recently moved to increase their RPS requirements by statute. So they have caught on to a good thing and are continuing and desiring and moving to expand it. Oregon electric consumers will also benefit from the RPS as it's laid out in this bill. With the cost caps that are built into Senate Bill 838, there's not a lot of downside for consumers from the bill, and there's an awful lot of upside if you believe that natural gas prices and prices for other fossil fuels will continue to be volatile and volatility increasing. A recent study of the wind resources that were added into the portfolio of the Public Service Company of Colorado in that state has indicated that the wind that they've already brought in has already saved customers money, and they're projecting substantial savings over the 15 or 20 years remaining in the lives of the projects that are already up and running. Final comment on with respect to some concerns that have been raised about transmission. We need transmission for virtually any new generation at this point in this region, and wind is no different, and the fact that it is in many cases more local than some of the other sources of generation that may be built may make it more economically viable than some of its some of the competing resources. There's been a lot of work dealing with the issue of integrating wind into the regional grid. There's a group that has been studying this issue led by the Bonneville Power Administration and Northwest Power and Conservation Council, and it recently issued a report that indicates that we can integrate 6,000 megawatts of wind into the Northwest grid at minimal cost to customers. So it can be done, and it can be done at low cost. So that concludes my statement. If you have any questions, happy to answer them.
Thank you.
Good afternoon. Now, for the record, my name is Mike Sullivan. I am the political director for AWPPW, the Association of Western Pulp and Paper Workers. AWPPW is opposed to Senate Bill 838 as it is presently written. There's a strong possibility of rate increases for the pulp and paper industry that could cause adverse effects in the daily operation to this very important industry to Oregon. Also, there is no regard for the cogeneration plants or the black liquor used as an energy source in many of our plants. Therefore, it is critical for this committee to look at these things for the sake of AWPPW's members. We work in an industry that the jobs should survive as we develop a science for clean energy. AWPPW would ask this committee to look very hard at the effects of Senate Bill 838 that it would have on our jobs we presently hold. Thank you for allowing me to state AWPPW's position, and I would answer any questions if there were any.
Thank you. Unless I'm wrong, on page 3, line 27, spent pulping liquor, otherwise known as black liquor,
okay.
Correct? It's in the bill.
Oh, okay, I missed that then. Thank you.
You're welcome. Any questions?
I've got a quick one for Kevin, if I may.
Sure.
Kevin, thank you. I missed your reference to the report, but I think what you were referring to is the joint news release report from the Power Planet. I'm sorry, they've changed this thing. Power and Conservation Council and BPA about wind.
Yes.
And, they did say, of course, that, they conclude that more wind power projects can be incorporated, but they also go on to say that wind by itself cannot provide reliable electric service, and the Northwest will need to build other resources to meet growing peak loads, which is one of my concerns. I mean, you know, with the existing thermal base or firm base that we've got now, how far can we go before we have to start putting online new firm base to be able to carry this wind that we're going to be growing?
Chair Dingfelder, Representative Burley, there is going to be a need to build more baseload generation as well as wind. There's no question about it. Wind is an especially valuable resource for backing out a lot of that generation when it's expensive to run, and the lack of fuel cost associated with wind and the lack of emissions are some of the benefits. As this legislation ramps up, you know, the integration issues aren't a problem, and the addition of baseload generation issues aren't a problem for a long time. You know, it's our expectation as a business that at some time in the not that distant future, other types of renewable generation will become much more economically viable and be able to provide a lot of baseload generating capacity, whether it's solar or geothermal or others.
Thank you. I feel like the offensive squad just left and the defensive squad came on.
Thank you, gentlemen. I appreciate it. I'm handing the gavel off because I needed a few members, and I have to go testify on a bill, and we'll call it the next panel, and I'll be right back. And Pat is timing at 3 minutes each.
So this is the next panel.
Those two, and then those three.
All right. Michael Early and Mark Nelson. You are in the room.
I don't want this one. No one here. There he is.
And a third stranger. When you're ready, go ahead, gentlemen.
Thank you. My name is Michael Early. I'm the Executive Director of Industrial Customers of Northwest Utilities. Appreciate the opportunity to be here today. First of all, ICNU supports cost-effective renewable resources. We participated in good faith in the Governor's Renewable Energy Task Force, but unlike many of the others who testified before you on Monday, we were excluded from the final working group that was put together that developed the final Senate bill that's before you today. And our concerns, frankly, many of them have not been addressed in that draft. In our view, the bill before you is not a balanced bill, and I'm here today to make recommendations for changes that would address our concerns. First, I think you heard on Monday that there was a rate cap in this bill, and you also heard that there was an off-ramp in this bill. I'm here to tell you that our view is that neither of those is true, that the so-called cost cap is not a rate cap. There is no assurance in this bill that rates will be limited to a 4% increase. Secondly, while 4% sounds small, it's applied to a very large number. And just for customers of PGE and PacifiCorp, the 4% rate cap over the 15 years from 2010 to 2025 means an additional $2.5 billion will be paid by customers without any additional energy or capacity being added to the system. Secondly, you also heard that there's an off-ramp. There is no off-ramp in this bill. Some have suggested that the alternative compliance payment is an off-ramp. It is not. At most, it is a delaying mechanism. So we support amendments that would address both of these concerns. We have amendments that propose an explicit rate cap, not just a cost cap, an explicit rate cap to protect customers. And we recommend a explicit off-ramp subject to the commission's discretion to protect customers if the costs of this bill become so high as to create a problem for customers or for the economy in general. Second point is the automatic adjustment clause. Simply put, it is not needed. It is unnecessary to accomplish the bill's goals related to renewable energy. And most importantly, it compromises customers' existing procedural rights. It's important to understand what is the situation without the automatic adjustment clause. Without a clause, such a clause, these costs are recovered in a general rate case. All the utilities' costs are at issue. The burden of proof is on the utility. Customers are entitled to discovery and an evidentiary hearing, and the rates are subject to suspension. under the proposed bill with the automatic adjustment clause. You can read the language. None of that is explicitly provided to customers. Now, you've heard from Chairman Beyer on Monday about what he believes the bill provides. And in my testimony, we have a question-by-question response to Chairman Beyer's letter and testimony. I encourage you to read that, but our conclusion is that although Chairman Beyer, as commissioner, while he sits on the commission, may be inclined to grant us these rights, the statute is going to be in place for a long time, and there's nothing in the statute and nothing that I believe he can point to that would compel his successor to grant us these rights. So we see a significant loss of rights with this provision, and it is unneeded for this bill. Lastly, we have concerns with the substantive provisions of the bill in terms of the arbitrary limitations on what counts as renewable. There is an exclusion for resources that would otherwise be renewable that are excluded simply because they were put in place prior to 1995. Why should the bill penalize early actors? Secondly, there is a geographic restriction in this bill, a resource that would otherwise be renewable simply because it's in Canada does not count under this bill. We've discussed for a long time the issue of hydro. This bill allows existing hydro wind, but in a very small amount, 50 average megawatts per utility. This is a nominal amount. We think an additional amount of hydro ought to be counted within this bill toward meeting these renewable requirements. Finally, as some of the other witnesses will testify, there's an unreasonable limitation on the definition of what counts as woody debris as a fuel for renewable resources. The point being that to the extent you limit what counts as an eligible resource, you limit supply, it means, and you mandate the amount of the demand, the price of compliance is going to go up. So we would like to see those limitations relaxed, and we've got amendments addressing each of those provisions as well. In conclusion, this bill is very important. We need to get it right, and we urge you to consider our amendments and to produce a bill that's more balanced, that's better for customers, better for the economy. Thank you.
Thank you. And Mr. Nelson, I'll ask you to be brief since Mr. Early used some of your time, I understand.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Mark Nelson, Public Affairs Counsel, representing Industrial Customers Northwest Utilities. We have provided you copies of the amendments that Mr. Early has referred to, and I had planned to touch upon them briefly, but let me take you to a couple documents that are in your package. As Mr. Early has indicated, currently when a renewable comes online or for any matter any kind of expansion of generation, there is a rate case. As part of that rate case, we look at that particular expansion of generation as well as all other activities involving the utility back to the last rate case. I take you to a document that's called Davidson Van Cleve. It's headed by that, and this reflects the rate cases over the last 4 years for PGE and Pacific Corps. And I take you to this document because of the importance of the rate case. An automatic adjustment clause, we maintain, will not get you to the same types of protections that we currently have under the rate case. And we maintain that's by design. The first two items there are pending cases, but I would take you to the second page, UE 179-2006 general rate case. Pacific Corps requested $112 million. Granted $43 million. I take you to the bottom of the page. Pacific Corps requested $102 million. Granted by the OPUs $25.9. Moving to the next page, the 2004 general rate case. Pacific Corps requested $57.9 million, settled for $8.5 million. Our message there is that the rate case provides the opportunity for all parties to come together in an evidentiary contested case process, which allows us to look at all costs with the utility and to determine what the proper level of rate should be. We believe very strongly if you remove the obligation, the requirement for a rate case, in each one of these instances where there are large number of dollars involved, you will severely impact the ability of ratepayers to contest some of these charges, and rates will certainly go up. We have also provided to you a one-page document that is Section 13 of the cost recovery section of Senate Bill 838. And I'm not sure if this was a mistake, but originally our understanding was the only thing that was going to be in the automatic adjustment clause were those costs prudently incurred that you find on lines 24 to 27 to construct or otherwise acquire facilities that generate electricity and or for associated electricity transmission. That was our understanding of what would go into an automatic adjustment clause. But what I believe, I hope, is a typographical error. All the costs that are in line 16 through 21, including interconnection costs, costs associated with using physical or financial assets to integrate, firm, or shape renewable energy sources on a firm annual basis, we believe that that also is going to be included by error. Under automatic adjustment clause. The error is in line 36 with a reference to section 13 sub 1. We believe that it should be a reference 13 sub 3 tying back to the capital cost, not all costs related to renewables. That was our understanding of what the agreement was. If I'm wrong, then we need to know that. But to add all those other costs to an automatic adjustment cost clause without an evidentiary process hearing, it just turns the whole PUC process, we believe, on its head. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you.
Madam Chair.
It's okay. We try to confuse people by handing the gavel back and forth.
Paul. Madam Chair, members of the committee, Paul Cosgrove representing the American Forest and Paper Association. And as you probably know, some of our members are amongst the major industrial users of electricity in the state and major employers. And we appreciate that this is one of the occasions in which union and management are on the same page with respect to an issue. And I appreciate Mike Sullivan's testimony before you. I'm going to briefly touch on five issues and how it particularly applies or affects the pulp and paper industry. The first one is on page 3 of the bill, the 1995, January 1, 1995 issue. And we have a specific example of in our industry of how this affects us. One of our companies has built a cogeneration facility that would qualify, except it's built before 1995. In another of its plants, it's built one after January 1, 1995. Now, it's upgraded the one, the earlier adopted cogeneration plant, but as written, only the portion of the capacity of that plant attributed to the upgrade, whatever that is, difficult to determine, frankly, is subject to be called qualifying electricity. We don't think that makes any sense from a policy perspective, and we don't believe it's particularly fair. The second issue is also on page 3, and it has to do in lines 28, 29, 30 with the definition of woody biomass. This body last year, with rather significant majorities in both houses, passed a bill, Senate Bill 1072, that in the context of energy generation and promoting biomass energy included a definition of woody biomass that is dramatically different from the one in this bill, and we see no reason to change what was good policy just 2 short years ago to the inadequate definition that's in this bill. Third, and because it's been discussed by Mr. Early, I will just say we agree that the 4% cost cap needs to be turned into a rate cap. That's a major concern for us. Fourth, the automatic adjustment clause. I'm not a utility lawyer, so I won't presume that I don't understand the intricacies of utility law, and it's a rather arcane area of law. I've learned that much. But it seems to me that if the automatic adjustment clause in this bill really changes nothing in terms of people's rights before the commission, then why have it in here? And if it's in here, it must change something. Our concern is this was not discussed, and some of our members spent a lot of time during the interim with a renewable energy work group. This was not part of that discussion. It's not necessary to this bill, and we think it's appropriate to leave the regulation of rates for the investor-owned utilities in the same place they are now, where the PUC has the authorities it has, and we have the rights that we have under the current law.
Well, you've got about 30 seconds to wrap up.
Because I'm at number 5 out of 5. The last thing is on the public purpose charge. The extension we oppose, but also the change in its purposes and uses. I point out that on page 15, lines 22 through 24, the 19% of the public purpose charge that we and others pay that's already dedicated to renewable energy resources is being rededicated to a very specific and narrow portion of that market, and we don't think that rededication to those very small and likely less economical projects is appropriate. Thank you, Madam Chair. I'd be happy to answer your questions.
Great. Thank you.
Did I do it?
You did great. You're just flashing right now. Representative McPherson has a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I'm going to throw this out to the panel generally. Like Mr. Cosgrove, I'm not a utility lawyer, so the arcane aspects of this area body law I don't really know much about. But I did look up the reference to that's in the bill to the existing ORS 757-210B, which describes an automatic adjustment clause that, it, by my just brief reading, looks like it's subject to review by the Commission at least once every 2 years, and under the terms of this bill requires an opportunity for public comment. So it would seem as though there's a time-limited time frame and that there is an opportunity for input. So what's troublesome to you about having a provision that is already in our law dealing with an opportunity to true up between general rate cases this kind of adjustment?
If I can give the non-utility lawyer answer to the non-utility lawyer, Madam Chair, Representative McPherson, 757-210 sub 1 sub B says an automatic adjustment clause means a provision of a rate schedule that provides for rate increases or decreases or both without prior hearing. That's the concern I have. The current automatic adjustment clause process is in law, and we're not proposing to change that. What we're proposing is not to change it with what's in the bill to something different. And it has limited applicability, as my understanding, has limited applicability in its current version and would have broader applicability under the new version. So it's the changes in the current law that we're concerned about.
You want to follow up?
If I could.
Yeah.
My reading of the bill is that there's a specific requirement in this bill to provide an opportunity for public comment. Now, it doesn't state whether that would be in the form of a prior hearing, but there is an opportunity for comment. And so it looks to me like we've got an existing structure in the law that allows for the use of automatic adjustment clauses, and then an additional procedural protection, which is that there be an opportunity for public comment before that existing mechanism is used for this purpose, for recovering costs under this renewable portfolio standard. So it's like you're getting existing law plus an additional protection.
If I could respond. An opportunity for public comment could be as simple as a notice and comment period. There's a notice put out by the commission. There's an opportunity to comment one of their regular public meetings. And they do that for a variety of non-rate issues. But that is materially different than what we have today, the process to get these costs into rates, which is in a general rate case with discovery, with an evidentiary hearing, with testimony, and all that, the full panoply of rights you normally think of in a full adjudicative hearing. So, frankly, we look at the provision that says opportunity for public comment, and that looks restrictive to us, not an addition, but restrictive.
Did you have a follow-up or a report?
Yeah, it is a follow-up.
Okay.
Oh, go ahead.
No, that's fine.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My understanding, staying with the automatic adjustment clause, is that we're really talking about a two-step process here, and this is what the chair of the PUC said. One is the establishing whether there will be a process that might result in a rate increase based on expense driving the need for that rate change. The second step, so that's step one. The second step is the process of public hearing, discovery, et cetera, that allows the interested parties to come forward and have a full hearing of that issue to decide whether that rate change is warranted. Does Senate Bill 838 propose to change that process that exists today?
I think we look at the bill, and the bill says opportunity for public comment, and it's not specific whether that applies to the establishment phase or the use phase. And as I discussed before, That is very different than what we have today in an evidentiary proceeding. And then if you look beyond 838 to the reference statute, to 557.2010, it's very explicit that an automatic adjustment clause means a provision of a rate schedule that provides for rate increases or decreases without prior hearing. So reading those in conjunction, I can't square the commissioner's understanding or intent with what I read in the bill before you and the existing statute. And that's why we're saying, if that's what the commissioner intends, if that's what you want, let's make it explicit, and we have an amendment for that.
And I'll let you respond. In the interest of time, I will be calling up the PUC towards the end of the hearing, which we've got to keep moving, otherwise we will not let all these people testify. So if you want to go ahead, and then I'm going to call up the next
panel. Briefly, Madam Chair, and I just handed out that particular amendment that Mr. Early has referenced. We have a rate case opportunity now, requirement, that we do now. It is being said that we're going to have something similar to that opportunity under this bill. As Mr. Early has indicated, we don't see the requirement for that opportunity. If there is misunderstanding, this amendment will address that, because it requires basically a rate case if you're going to use the automatic adjustment clause. So if we're not going to stay with our process now, which allows for that opportunity, and we're going to some other process, we believe we'd like to protect our ability to do this, we believe Dash 24 will do that.
Thank you, gentlemen. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
We have some people that came from over 100 miles that did show up, and that's Sylvia Hayes and Eric Peterson. If you can come up, please. And we're asking people to keep their comments to 3 minutes due to time constraints, and state your name for the record.
Me or you?
Go ahead.
All right. Well, Madam Chairperson and committee members, thanks for having us up here, even though we were late. There's construction on the passes these days. I'm Sylvia Hayes. I'm Executive Director of 3E Strategies. We're a nonprofit based out of Bend, and we work statewide on energy issues. I've also been a member of the Governor's Renewable Energy Working Group, and so have been intimately involved with putting together SB 838. One of 3E Strategies' major programs is the Business Alliance for Sustainable Energy, which is comprised of members of the clean energy industry across the state and other key stakeholders. Those include PV Powered, Idatech, Cascade Sunworks, the Warm Springs Forest Products, Stoll Reeves, Perkins Coie, and most recently the Bend Chamber of Commerce. I'll be very brief because I've had a chance to speak with you before, particularly at the information session that you had in Bend. I just want to stress that on behalf of our members, both 3E Strategies and the Business Alliance for Sustainable Energy, we do urge you to support Senate Bill 838. And I will reiterate a couple of the points that I've made previously. One of my great concerns and the concerns of our membership is that if Oregon does not move quickly to pass a renewable energy standard, we're at risk of losing two prime opportunities. The first one is, again, and I will reiterate that we've got two clean energy projects that are moving in central Oregon, one for geothermal development, one for a biomass facility. Both of those have pending power sales contracts with California firms. So I'm very concerned that since we are now surrounded by states that have renewable energy standards, if we don't move on this, we're likely to lose some of our very best homegrown renewable energy resources to surrounding states. The second opportunity that we're at risk of losing by not moving boldly and quickly on this particular issue is there are now a number of states that see the economic advantage in becoming leaders in this emerging clean energy industry. And although Oregon has an amazing diversity of renewable energy resources, we've got over 200 clean energy companies so far, I have already personally met with prospective businesses interested in Oregon who are unwilling to lay down the capital investment with barring some kind of a investor guarantee policy, and that's what they look to renewable energy standards as. So I think if we're going to really walk the talk and not just talk it about becoming a leader in the industry, I think a renewable energy standard is extraordinarily important. I also just want to reiterate that this is not just a Portland issue. There's statewide support for passage of a renewable energy standard. There's statewide support for Oregon really taking bold steps to become a leader in the clean energy industry. And finally, I just want to also reiterate that 3E Strategies members and members of our Business Alliance for Sustainable Energy are quite confident and with SB 838. It's well written. We've had a lot of industry support in getting it to this point. We feel that there are adequate and effective safeguards to cost increases and for ratepayers. Thanks.
Thank you.
I'll be really brief, Madam Chair, fellow committee members.
Can you state your name for the record?
Eric Peterson. I'm the Vice President of Sales and Marketing for PV Powered. We're a manufacturer of solar-powered inverters in Bend. We sell our products all over the U.S. I think this is a phenomenal piece of legislation for the planet, for our country, for the state, and certainly for all of us in the renewable energy business in Oregon. It sets challenging but I think very achievable standards, and I think it really is an opportunity for industry, us as citizens, and our utility providers to come together and figure out how to solve these problems. Change is never easy for us as citizens, for us as business executives, or for all of you, but we have an opportunity to put Oregon back in front on the environment and also really do a significant amount of good for those of us in the clean energy business. And this would be a help for us not only for the environment but also for us as business leaders. And I urge your support.
Thank you. And thank you, by the way, for hosting us, the
welcome. Thanks
committee.
For coming over.
For the audience, we had a tour of PV Power facilities about a month ago in Bend, and really appreciate it. And Sylvia, thanks for your presentation there as well. Any questions for this panel?
No.
Thank you for coming. Okay, next I'm going to invite up Julie Brandis, Rob Ferris, and Mike McCullum.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, for your record, I am Julie Brandis with Associated Oregon Industries. Associated Oregon Industries Board of Directors supports the adoption of a renewable portfolio standard, and we would like to support Senate Bill 838. To support the bill, we need modifications. The current legislation is in conflict with the RPS and public purpose principles our AOI Energy Committee spent a year developing and our AOI board formalized. Recently, our executive committee met on March 23rd, and our board met April 9th, and we reaffirmed this position on working to get to yes. And getting to yes depends on you and your willingness to open this legislation for amendments. We recognize that you are cautious about modifying the work of those who worked hard on the Senate side to produce Senate Bill 838. It seems, I'm sure, that one change could topple an agreement. Nevertheless, if the past is any predictor, we are better off when energy bills reach a higher level of agreement and the consumers and the business community have concerns met and reach a level of comfort as well. Representative Dingfelder, the very first bill I asked you to support was Senate Bill 1149. I think it was your first day at the legislature, as a matter of fact. That was a collaborative effort, and AOI stood by that deal and acted in good faith with its implementation, and our record speaks to that. With that in mind, AOI's first request is that you assist us in keeping with the underlying agreement of Senate Bill 1149, the public purpose charge. Currently, more than $11 million is collected in public purpose charges to buy down the above market cost of renewables. Perhaps this was the infancy of the RPS. The intent of the originating legislation speaks very clearly. An electric company that satisfies its obligation under this section shall have no further obligation to invest in new renewable energy resources. AOI represents hundreds of manufacturers, most of them in private utility territory. In the interest of fairness, this money should count toward the cost cap since it comes from the same pocketbooks. Customers should not be charged twice. Once for the RPS, and once for a renewable program in the Energy Trust. Mr. Ferris, who joins me today, pays $9,500 a year to the ETO just for renewables. one of PGE's largest customers, pays $8,000 a month to the ETO just for renewables, for buying down the above-market cost. Our members just cannot understand why this financial contribution that comes from customers should not be counted in the customers and investments in renewables, and therefore should be counted within the cost cap. Imagine if the situation were strangely reversed. Suppose, Representative Dingfelder, that in 1999 I had asked you to support the RPS, and today we're debating the public purpose charge. It would be hard to suggest that a separate fund collecting revenues from customers to buy down the above-market cost for small-scale renewable resources should not count toward the customer's financial commitment to renewables. We have other concerns within this legislation. You've heard about the cost cap. I do not need to repeat that. Mike McCallum is going to talk specifically about the energy efficiency amendments in Section 5. And Rob Ferris is going to talk about the forest biomass definition. And we will have, I'll be able to hand out our testimony a little bit later today to you. That includes our other concerns, including a broader definition of key resources.
Thank you. Gentlemen?
Go ahead.
Microphone.
Chairman Dingfelder, my name is Rob Ferris, and our family runs Ferris Lumber Company, and we recently started a company called Evergreen Biopower. We've been in business 85 years, and we've taken the largest project on in our history, building a 10-megawatt cogen plant. And I think Representative Burley has extended an invitation to you and the committee that if you'd like to visit our facility, it's just 23 miles east of I-5 in Lyons, and it's going to be running 24/7, so you can come anytime. The boiler portion of it is operational today. It started this month, and the turbine generator side will be operational in August, probably late August. It will provide firm power to the communities of Lyons, Mill City, and Sile. And the reason I'm here today is that this bill effectively cuts out biomass because of the definition. The definition can be changed to match a definition passed into law last session under ORS 526-277 to allow biomass to contribute to the renewable portfolio standard. I request the committee amend Senate Bill 838A to include the biomass definition in last session Senate Bill 1072. Biomass is preferred by the utilities because it is firm and reliable compared to solar and wind, and redundant transmission expenses is not needed. That's all. That concludes my comments.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, Chairman Dingfelder, members of the committee. My name is Mike McCallum. I'm the president and CEO of the Oregon Restaurant Association, also speaking today on behalf of the Oregon Lodging Association. We are the state's largest private sector employer, and I believe we're the biggest portion of what is the commercial class customers of investor-owned utilities in the state. Consequently, we've been involved in this energy debate for, frankly, too long. From Senate Bill 1149, Senate Bill 408, we've been learning a lot about this stuff every step of the way. Our industry is all about sustainability, and we support the concepts of Senate Bill 838 completely. I do, though, share many of the concerns that have been outlined well today by AOI, most specifically the issue around a rate cap versus a cost cap. We think that would give commercial class customers a great deal more comfort with the concepts of 838. And we do have some question around the effectiveness of the off-ramps that are in the bill, and think that the suggestions made by ICNU could help improve the comfort level to commercial class customers there as well. But most specifically, in Section 5, as Julie referenced, there's a major change in this legislation, and it really does allow investor-owned utilities to now put energy efficiency measures back into rates. And that's something that was taken out in 1149 when we instituted the public purpose charge and said, that's where we're going to fund energy efficiency measures. After a lot of work and discussion, most specifically with representatives from PGE as well as Chairman Beyer of the PUC, we come to understand much better what Section 5 does. And frankly, 45. I'm sorry, 45. And we do support that. We think that it makes sense. But if we're going to adopt that new and that changed approach, we think you need to adopt an additional amendment to this bill. And it's the A25 amendments that Representative Burley's had drafted, and all they really do is take away the ability of the PUC to further increase the public purpose charge on commercial class and residential customers. If we're going to do energy efficiency back in rates, we don't think we should also be exposed to further rate increases in the public purpose charge. So it's pretty simple. I've talked about it with Chairman Beyer. He says, hey, Mike, we wouldn't do that anyway. And I said, good. So let's go ahead and give that assurance by making the change in the statute. So that's really our primary need within this bill, is to address further exposure for increases above what is anticipated in rates now under Senate Bill 838. And then finally, I just came from the Governor's Tourism Conference, and while rural Oregon is thrilled with the potential economic development from things like wind power, they wanted me to voice some caution around the placement of too many wind towers. There's a thing called a vision impediment that happens with many of these renewable energy things, and we just hope that as we pursue this sustainable path, we'll also be sensitive to one of Oregon's primary economies, which is a tourism economy, and make sure that we don't do any unnecessary damage to that clean and sustainable industry as well. That concludes my comments, Madam Chair.
Thank you. I think we have some questions.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Julie, I'm glad you brought up the question about the public purpose charge. And, Mike, you touched on Sections 45, 46 that allows virtually unlimited increase in it for energy conservation. But I've got several questions around this. One is, Julie, you said that you think the $11 million that's collected roughly to cover the above-market costs ought to be included in the RPS. But why would we not include even the conservation measures? I mean, the trust is collecting the public purpose charge, I think, is what, somewhere in the magnitude of $80-90 million a year. These are all energy conservation and development dollars. Why aren't we counting all of that towards the RPS?
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, I can't answer that question. I think you need to ask the governor's office that question. What we've been told is that this is a renewables package, and that's why I focused my comments and concerns about the public purpose charge as it relates to the renewable portion. Our members, when we signed 1149 and made that agreement, actually in the AOI boardroom, we really did look at the RPS, that 19% of the 3%, as buying down the above market cost, and the utilities obligation would have been met. So we see this as a fundamental change to that agreement. As for the conservation, again, that would be up to the governor's office to share with you their concerns.
Okay. Follow up. Sure. Regarding the green tag policy, and I believe I discussed this a little bit during the hearing on Monday and some of the concerns I had, in fact, really Rob, based on your experience in that with Rough and Ready with the trust and the tags. And it's rather perhaps timely, I guess, if you will, that I was handed this afternoon, just before we started here, March 28, 2007, this is very recent, a resolution by the Energy Trust that they have amended their green tag policy. And I haven't had the chance to read this and understand it, but I'm starting to have a little bit of concern here about, you know, who's setting the policy on some of these types of issues. And, Rob, if you wouldn't mind sharing with us a little bit the experience that you had with the trust regarding your grant application and the conditions with the tags.
We responded to a request for proposal, as did many others, by the Energy Trust, and over 100 megawatts were proposed from this request for proposals. Ours was the largest with 10 megawatts. And we went all the way down the road with the Energy Trust, and we got to the end, and they offered us $1.8 million, but they required to own the green tags or the renewable energy credits for 20 years. And we didn't think that that was a fair deal for what we viewed as a de minimis amount of money compared to a $22 million project. And every other forest products company that was given a similar arm twisting by the Energy Trust told them to forget it. And so out of this 100 megawatts of power, they got down to the last company, which was Rough and Ready, and they had a 1.5 megawatt project. And they offered them $1.7 or $1.8 million for a 1.5 megawatt project versus the same money for a 10 megawatt project. And so I just think they may have gotten red-faced about it and had to give some money someplace. They certainly didn't value the green tags the same way for us as they did Rough and Ready. And I'm happy for Rough and Ready. It made the project go. But we thought we'd never entered into an agreement 20 years in length with anyone under any circumstances. And the value of those green tags are subjected today, but they may be worth quite a bit. On the East Coast, they're worth $50. And if you look at the number of green tags that we would make over a 20-year period, that's been multiplied by that time frame. It's $1.50 per green tag. So that's what we were offered. If you use the time value of money, you can get up to $3. But the way the Energy Trust works.
Thank you. Madam Chair, thanks. I appreciate your indulging me. I just want to again highlight for the fact that we spent a lot of time in this bill looking at standards, looking at cost recovery, looking at things, and to me, this is a very key part of the policy and making this work, because not only from the investment perspective is this part of your financial payback calculations, but also how do these credits work towards the RPS and who gets them and who uses them for compliance. So I think it's an important piece of the policy discussion that really hasn't had a lot of attention.
Thank you. Quickly, Representative Smith, we have a lot of people up to testify.
Give Representative Burley 10 minutes, and I'm told quickly.
I'm cutting him off next time, believe me.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I don't throw this question to the panel, but I throw it out to the audience. We've heard these three individuals share with us information on amendments relating to the public purpose charge and the rate cap versus cost cap. I guess I would like to hear from folks in the audience how these amendments that they're asking us to consider is going to diminish the intent of this legislation. I haven't heard that. And so I appreciate these questions. I think you bring legitimate issues before us, and I think it's incumbent upon the folks in the audience now to share with us how what you're proposing diminishes it. Thank you, Madam Chair.
And I'll ask every member of the audience to have that conversation with Representative Smith outside. Not here.
Well, I would hope, Madam Chair, that they would address it. We need to get beyond a superficial conversation of this is great legislation. Let's get into the nuts and bolts. We've got issues that are important to industry in the state of Oregon. Let's figure out how we can solve this and make this a good issue that works for all Oregonians.
Thank you. And I do have one quick question, Chair's prerogative, since I haven't asked. I've heard concern about the rate versus cost cap, and here's what I'm a little perplexed about. My understanding is right now, under existing law, there is no caps, period. Is that correct? Okay. So I guess that's where I'm sort of hung up, is that under the current rate-making process, there is no caps, whether it's based on revenue or based on the rates. So I have a hard time understanding why there's opposition to now including a cap where there is no cap existing.
Go ahead, Jerry. I think the and again, I'm not a utility lawyer, and I'm glad. But
I think we're all glad. Yeah, nobody here is a utility lawyer.
And so I may be completely misspeaking, but I'm going to take a stab. I think the concept here is all around making sure that whatever we do to achieve these renewable standards doesn't just blow rates out of the water without having due process around that. So when we say there's a rate cap, I don't think we're necessarily saying it means the rate can't go up. It does mean that, in fact, there will be a due process. There will be a rate hearing around any action in relation to renewables that might break a particular level. That's my understanding of it, and that's what we would seek to achieve.
Do you want to respond before I kick you guys off the podium?
No, I don't think you have to physically kick us off. But just, you know, I haven't mentioned a rate cap in our testimony. That is, again, I think that's a question that the previous panel or their actual certified people who are, I think Mr. Eisendorf said it well the other day, those masochists who spend a lot of time doing energy rate stuff. But I think the concern that we have, we do not have any rate caps in current law. The concern we have is, nor do we have a piece of legislation that mandates that utilities acquire 25% of their power acquisitions, of 25% of that to be of any one thing, whether it's natural gas or whether it's coal or anything. There's nothing like that in current statute. So there's uncertainty, and there's concern from the customers who pay a great deal of money to for their power to remain competitive, and they have a footprint in Oregon, an economic footprint. And all we're saying is it's almost like having a hypothesis or null hypothesis. Some people will say, this cost cap, it works. It really provides good protections. And I think what you're hearing from us is, prove it to us. We're not sure. And since you can't prove it to us without implementation, take some time to make sure the protections are clear and that the cost cap truly is what it purports to be, because it is not a rate cap and it is not really rate protection.
Okay. All right. Thank you very much for your testimony. Appreciate it. We're going to move along so we can try to fit everybody in and do the best I can. Next is Scott Bolton and Jeremiah Bauman. And actually, I think I'm going to, at the same time, I'm just going to have to call up panels of three so we can get folks up here.
Chair. Madam Chair. I also have a third.
Oh, you have a third. Yeah. Okay. I guess we'll call it a threesome then. Okay. Jeremiah.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and members of the committee. For the record, Jeremiah Bauman with Osberg, the Oregon State Public Interest Research Group. In the interest of time, I will skip right past the many benefits of this bill that have been talked about, I think, by a lot of people that would benefit from that, from those factors all over the state. And I'll instead try to respond to a bunch of issues that have come up, in particular the newer ones today. And I'll try to do so quickly, although there are certainly a lot of questions that have come up. Let me first comment on process, because we've heard, I think, some complaints about who did and did not participate in discussions. The Governor's Renewable Energy Working Group met for, I believe, over a year with about 35 stakeholders, including everybody, and a lot of the people who have testified today, and certainly everybody who has concerns about the bill. In addition, some of the advocates for this policy brought together a smaller group at the same time with the utilities and the industrial customers and associated Oregon industries that met for about 6 months trying to find some common ground. In addition, on the Senate side, as the process moved through there, the governor's office asked anybody who was interested in working to get to a bill people could agree to, working to get to yes, to come together and work on a bill. Mm-hmm. And people who have concerns about the bill chose not to participate because their position at that point was they could not come to agreement on the bill, and so it didn't seem constructive. So I think there's been a very inclusive process involving a lot of people and a lot of work, and probably weeks collectively of various people's time working on these policies. And a lot of these issues I feel like have been very well addressed, and all sides have made many, many concessions to try to make this bill workable. Let me hit on the specific issues very briefly. First, on the biomass issue, this body, the Oregon House of Representatives, has adopted this exact biomass language in the biofuels bill. My understanding is a lot of the people that are objecting today did not object to that language in that bill, and only four people in the House for dissented to that bill. So that language was included specifically to address some of the concerns and to find language that we thought would actually have consensus. Let me talk briefly about some of the hydro concerns that have come up. This bill includes a lot of hydropower. It actually treats hydropower primarily the same as all renewable resources in terms of the start date, and then gives it special protections in terms of making sure utilities don't give up hydropower, allows for efficiency upgrades at older dams, allows older dams before the start date to count if they are made into low-impact dams, And in fact, includes quite broad provisions for new hydropower. In fact, from an environmental perspective, there are a lot of concerns that there aren't restrictions on new hydro that could lead to environmentally damaging dams, but this bill represents a compromise on new hydro. Third issue, it's been proposed that we should remove the 1995 start date and count all existing resources, and then just raise the 25% up to, you know, somewhere in the neighborhood of 70 or 75% to have the same effect on new renewable resources. That would have a dramatic impact on cost in a negative direction, and by negative I mean bad, not reduced cost. The hydropower system is very, very large and fluctuates widely year to year. That means that if you're a utility and you're approaching a 75% target and you think you're 70% renewable and you have a low water year, you could lose a significant amount of your renewable energy that year and be forced into short-term market purchases of electricity, which is some of the most expensive electricity that you can buy. So we think that would be a very damaging provision in terms of increasing the cost of compliance for this bill and making it very difficult for utilities to manage where they're at relative to the targets in the bill. Fourth, let me comment on the cost cap. I trust Mr. Early's math that there would be billions of dollars that could potentially be added to cost over 20 years when you're talking about two of the largest companies in the state of Oregon. The reality is those numbers sound incredibly large, but they are 4% of the utility's cost, and the utility's cost is what is translated into rates. It is, in fact, a very good proxy for rates, although it's true that it is not a direct cap on rates themselves. The rates are set based on that cost. But whether it's $1.5 billion or $2.5 billion, it is still 4% and reflects at no more than a 4% increase in cost. I'd also like to differ with one characterization that the 4% will be paid over the next 20 years. This bill does not choose to invest 4% of ratepayers' money in renewable energy projects. That is the policy that exists through the public purposes charge to invest what amounts to about one-half of 1% of ratepayers' money into renewable above-market costs for renewable energy. The cost gap is a safety net. We hope it never will be triggered. And in all the states that have these policies in place so far, none of them have been triggered because costs have all been negligible for complying with these.
Jeremiah, I need you to wrap up, please.
Let me just then, since the PUC has commented on the automatic adjustment clause, let me close by commenting on the public purpose charge inclusion issue. The reason that the cost cap does not count the $11 million in renewable costs towards the cost cap is because the cost cap is protecting ratepayers against potential cost increases for this bill. It's not trying to limit investments that the state has already chosen to make. And while the current investments are large for some companies because they have large energy bills, $8,000 a month is still about one-half of 1% of the energy bill. And so we don't think this is extraordinary cost. We think this bill contains excellent consumer protections.
Thank you.
Chair Dingfelder, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Scott Bolton. I'm Government Affairs Manager for Pacific Power. With me today is Brent Gale, who is Senior Vice President for Mid-American Energy Holding Company, our parent company. He is a utility lawyer. So just so that we brought at least one.
I have one thing to say. I'm sorry.
I have to say this makes water law look pretty simple.
So in the interest of time, and so we can get right to Representative Burley, your questions and the rest of the committee, I just want to say for Pacific Power, it was not easy for us to come into the debate and readily accept the earliest versions of Senate Bill 838. We felt like there had to be a little bit more flesh on the bone, and we felt like there had to be more consumer protection. Because we're not in the business of gouging our customers. We want our customers to be successful. We want our customers to stay in Oregon and continue to have well-paying jobs, especially for us, Pacific Power being primarily a rural power company in the state of Oregon. We operate in 24 of the 36 counties. We have just a tiny bit of Portland, and we're really the power company for Southern Oregon and for Central Oregon and for Eastern Oregon. So that's really our focus, and certainly as we advocate for policies within this bill, is not with any mind to harm or to disadvantage our customers. And so I think to respond to some of the testimony that you've heard here today, I'd just like to address head-on the automatic adjustment clause provision within the bill. As Senator Atkinson testified to on Monday, we asked for that inclusion of the language in the bill, and we did so understanding a basic economic principle, that if Senate Bill 838 is to meet a energy policy that prefers renewable energy, it should do so in the most affordable basis possible. And in order to have the most optionality and the opportunity to bring the lowest cost resources to our customers, we felt like we needed to treat purchase power, or basically market power purchased from a developer, the same as the utility's own investment. That if we had a level playing field and we had the same treatment, regulatory treatment, for how those investments and those costs are measured, that would level the playing field and remove a bias towards purchase power that we currently have under the automatic adjustment mechanism that we have for purchase power. Automatic adjustment mechanisms are fairly common. They're frankly becoming more common after the last two sessions of the legislature, and we feel that beyond just removing a disincentive for utility investment so that the renewable power that we do bring to our customer is the lowest cost possible, we also believe that having a general rate case every time a utility invests to meet the standard creates undue cost pressures and undue rate volatility for our customers. As you heard from the industrial customers themselves, when we go in for a general rate case, it's an all-in proposition. It's every cost. My company, at least, would very much like to live within our means. I don't think that the end of general rate cases is over if this bill passes with an automatic adjustment clause, but we do feel like this is a much fairer treatment, again, of our investment. And frankly, the third reason that we think that this is important is it does match the costs and benefits of renewable energy that we are adding to our system. Right now, those costs and benefits are not matched because the benefits are being passed through to ratepayers immediately once these projects are in service, and yet under the current system, we are unable to begin recovering on our capital investment until a general rate case. We think that this is sound public policy. We think that hopefully at this point in the committee's examination of this issue, the questions around due process and whether the commission has proper oversight and customers have the ability to petition the commission for a hearing and have the ability to have discovery and their full evidentiary rights has been resolved. I handed to the committee administrator an automatic adjustment mechanism, one that exists today for our power purchases. That automatic adjustment mechanism starts in April, concludes sometime in November, with lots of meetings, lots of briefings, hearings, and ample opportunity for discovery to find out what our costs are, what is the case that we're presenting for recovering these costs, and was it prudent? Did we do the right thing? Should we get it all, or should we get a portion, or should we get none? That's the commission's job, and that will be preserved under 838 with this language. And just one last comment, and I'll shut up, is the language around that Representative McPherson mentioned around opportunity for public comment. We see that as belt and suspenders language, that not only does the statute under Section 13 reference 757.210, which is the procedure that all these automatic adjustment clauses, including existing ones, operate under, but we also put in added language to make very clear that there will always be an opportunity and that the Commission will have added direction to ensure that consumers have every opportunity to be heard and to have their ability to have their day in court with the Public Utility Commission. And with that, I'll close and welcome your questions.
Okay. And as a Pacific Core customer, and most of my constituents are customers, I'm glad you're on the record saying you're not trying to gouge us. That makes me feel better.
I can't say that enough, Madam Chair.
Would you like to add something, or it's just respond to questions?
Honorable Chair and Representative, Honorable Representatives and Madam Chair, I would just like to answer the questions if that's acceptable.
Okay, great. Any questions?
Madam Chair, quickly, and to Scott, if I understood you correctly, would it be accurate to say that without an automatic adjustment clause, customers would be more likely to see the cost of renewables reflected in a steep and sudden price increase rather than phased in over time? You'd have to go back. In other words, you'd have to go backwards to collect. You'd have to collect costs,
correct,
that you've already,
yes,
incurred.
Madam Chair, Representative Cannon, that is correct. And also the automatic adjustment clause expedites the ability to pass through such benefits such as the production tax credit rather than waiting for a fully litigated general rate case. So, again, there are benefits to the automatic adjustment clause that, frankly, haven't been brought to light up to this point in the testimony.
Great. Thank you. Representative Smith?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a quick comment. Jeremy, I just want you to know how much I appreciate your approach to issues. Don't always agree with you, but I do want you to know I think you're a true professional. Thank you for your approach.
Thank you, Representative Smith.
Anyone else for the fan club here?
Thank you. Just quickly, Scott, to follow up on Representative Cannon's question, the notion of going through the rate setting process where you reach back after you know, you've got your capital investment, you can figure out your rates. I mean, we do this all the time anyways. So we don't have these huge jumps. It's, you know, however the rate setting's done, we don't have these huge 15% increases because you just put another thermal plant online. So we're not, that process is still the same, isn't that correct? The rate setting process, we're not changing that at all.
Madam Chair, Representative Burley, no, there's nothing in Senate Bill 838 or in this automatic adjustment clause language that changes the current general rate making process.
Okay. Follow up. So with this automatic adjustment clause, and I think you heard the conversation earlier about 13 subsection 1 and 3 and then section 13A and the question there. But before we get into that, what I'm curious about is, with the automatic adjustment clause, is it your understanding that you would be able to recover the cost not only of the renewable resource itself or the facility that produces the renewable energy, but also whatever you need as far as integrating, firming, or shaping?
Yeah.
Madam Chair and Representative Burley. What we're allowed to recover under the adjustment clause, as I view it, are the capital costs of the renewables that we own, as well as any power purchases that might be necessary for the shaping or the firming. Currently, we already have adjustment clauses that will recover the power purchase cost if we were to purchase the renewables from a third party. That particular clause also recovers the variable costs of the facilities that we own. What the clause does not recover are the fixed or the capital costs of the facilities that we own. And we choose to own facilities when it's the least cost for our customers. As a result, the current situation that we have in the statute, or in the rules rather, provides a disincentive for the utility to own renewables, even when that is the least cost option for the customers. What the automatic adjustment clause provision attempts to do in section 13.3 is to simply say that in addition to being able to pass through the benefits of the renewables through an automatic adjustment clause, the utility will have the opportunity to match those benefits with the costs and recover the costs through an adjustment mechanism. The alternative is not to pass the benefits through and wait until a rate case to do so. But when we own the renewable kilowatt hours have a zero variable cost. As a result, customers in Oregon receive free energy, essentially, through the adjustment mechanism. For every 100 megawatts of renewables that PacifiCorp owns, the benefit to Oregon customers is about $4 million of that free energy. What we're simply asking is that there be a matching. We can't give away free energy just as the industrial customers don't give away free product. Customers have to pay for those benefits. We're asking that we be allowed to recover those costs, and that's what Section 13.3 does.
Thank you for the clarification.
Follow up. I'm still not quite clear on this, Brent, because I mean you mentioned the power purchase for shaping and firming, but I would suspect at some point you're going to be at the point where you no longer have that firm base load to shape and firm, and there may not be any power purchase available to shape and firm, and you're going to have to go out and do some construction of some sort in order to be able to have that base to back it up. Would you be able to pass those costs along through the automatic adjustment clause?
I do not, Madam Chair and Honorable Representative Burley, I do not believe that those costs of, say, adding a gas plant were intended to be recovered under Section 13A or Section 13.3. Section 13.3 clearly does not contemplate that. Section 13.1 has reference to the shaping. There is a, if you look at Section 13A, and that went through several iterations, by the way, 13A is really just a timing provision. And what 13A was intended to do was to say to the Commission, you have to adopt these rules that establish the adjustment mechanism by a given date. And as this process went on, certain language got added to Section 13A, including a reference to Section 13.1. The intent, however, though, because that is a section that gives the Commission a timeline, it's only going to apply to those costs that those costs that the Commission considers at the time it adopts the rate. So I do not see that a gas generating plant that would be added in the future could be included in that clause through the reference to section 13.1. Is that helpful? It could have been clearer if it said 13.3. Do I think it's material, or is there a need for a material change to change Section 13A to refer to Section 13.3? As Mr. Early indicated, no. I don't believe it's necessary. I believe that the statute can be interpreted, or the bill can be interpreted correctly without that change.
But if we changed it, just to be clear, would that be a problem for your...
If the reference to Section 13.1 in Section 13A was changed, and that's the only change in 13A, to Section 13.3, that probably does not have a material impact on our willingness to support the bill. I can't speak for anybody else.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. And thank you, gentlemen. I appreciate it. We're going to have to move on to the next panel, but I appreciate your comments.
Madam Chair, can I add one more point on this last topic, Representative Burley? I think one point we haven't talked about a lot today in the Section 13 and 13A, the most important language in my mind here from a ratepayer protection standpoint is the phrase prudently incurred, which occurs in every relevant paragraph. As Sherman Beyer testified, that's the language that guarantees the same standard for what is and is not recoverable and guarantees the right to a hearing and discovery in that process. And that's the, I think, most important part of this ratepayer protection.
Okay.
I don't agree with that last comment.
Okay. Thank you, gentlemen. Appreciate it. Is there anybody here, by the way, we're going to end up, because we have more people to testify than time, if there's anybody here who cannot come back on Friday, could you please go over and let Ian know? I'm going to keep working through the list, but we're going to end up holding the hearing over on Friday as well, the public hearing portion. Okay, next is Sandy Flicker and Don Goddard, and I'm also going to call up Paul Wooden with him, since we're doing threes. Okay, come on up. Hey, Don, you're ready? Why don't you go first?
Thank you, Madam Chairman and members of the committee. I'm Don Goddard, represent the Oregon PUDs, six PUDs in the state of Oregon. First comment I would make is we're real proud of our history of renewable resources. Our customers can take pride, like other consumer-owned utilities, that 95% of their power is probably carbon-free. Our members have developed everything from a dairy digester to small hydro to cogeneration and the like. There are good things in this bill that we appreciate. Our legislation is very unique to PUDs. We need to have it upgraded to allow us to be successful in acquiring renewable resources, and the Chairman of Vakin was very gracious in including those provisions in the bill. We also like the cost cap, and particularly that portion that allows the local governing board of PUDs and consumer-owned utilities to decide whether or not the cost cap has been reached. There's three things that we would like to see improved in the bill. We believe that the threshold for the 25% requirement should be raised to 3%, so that it would exempt all six PUDs rather than the four that are presently exempt from the 25% requirement. It would still be subject to the 5% requirement. Our reason for that is in existing PUD statutes, most of the resources have to be voted on by our members. In the testimony, you can see a list of projects that our consumers have voted to support. We don't think there's a compelling reason for the state to preempt those local decisions. The third point that I would make is non-firm power from the Bonneville Power Administration is a very valuable resource. Oregon ought not to be giving that up and selling it off to California or neighboring states. It's a bad decision, bad policy for Oregon. The last point that I would make is the one you've heard before, is the 1995 cutoff date. Our members have been leaders in developing new resources. Emerald PUD developed the landfill project at Short Mountain south of Eugene in 1991. And another of our members developed a small hydro, fish family hydro project actually at the Dalles Dam. We don't think those folks should be disadvantaged because they did it earlier than others. Thank you for the chance to make our comments.
Thank you for your input. Appreciate it. Sandy.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Sandy Flicker, and I represent the Oregon Rural Electric Cooperative Association. There are 18 electric cooperatives that serve less than 10% of Oregon, but 65% of the geography of Oregon. We are incredibly small utilities. I'm going to keep my comments brief. First of all, I would concur with Mr. Goddard's comments and also say that we are very proud of the fact that we use emission-free power. I have a chart that I have had brought to share with you. You can see very quickly that consumer-owned utilities basically contribute nothing to the emissions in the state. So that's the first comment I want to make, is that we don't believe we are part of an emissions problem in this state. We don't believe we will ever be a part of the emissions problem in this state. We certainly support renewable power. We use renewable power. We'll continue to use renewable power. And we're not here to oppose Senate Bill 838. But as Mr. Goddard suggested, we also believe that there are some amendments that need to be made to Senate Bill 838. And those amendments have to do with basically who's in and who's out. Just a couple of brief comments on history. We also were part of the Renewable Energy Working Group, and the first thing we asked the Renewable Energy Working Group was to give consumer-owned utilities a separate path. We did not get a separate path. The second thing we asked was we asked for a 5% an exemption of up to 5% of state load or under 25,000 customers. Or excuse me, I guess at the time it was under 50,000 customers. We didn't get that. So the third thing we asked for was an exemption, and which we're asking for now is an exemption of less than utilities that serve less than 3% of state load. And we spent a little bit of time here this morning talking about Senate Bill 1149, and I thought it would be also a good idea to remind you of some of the other things that were in Senate Bill 1149, and I've given you a copy of that statute. And under 757669, it says the policy regarding consumer-owned electric utilities. The Legislative Assembly declares it is the policy of the State of Oregon regarding consumer-owned utilities to preserve and enhance the ability of community-based consumer-owned utilities to provide reliable electric power to their consumers. Recognize that communities served by consumer-owned utilities located in various parts of the state may differ in their needs and desires concerning the provision of electricity and related products and services. Preserve and enhance the ability of consumer-owned utilities and their elected governing bodies to respond to their consumers' needs and desires. Retain local control over consumer-owned utilities that provide or distribute electricity to retail electricity consumers. Preserve, clarify, and as provided herein, enhance the rights and authorities of consumer-owned utilities and their governing bodies. That is in state law as we speak today. It is our opinion that moving that exemption up to 1.5% does nothing more than pick and choose among utilities with no basis in policy whatsoever. I've also provided for you some information out of my directory, and there's two utilities here. There's Umatilla Electric Utility, which would be in the 25 by 25 mandate, and there's Oregon Trail Electric Utility, would be out of the 25 by 25 mandate. And I want you to look closely at the information on these two utilities. Umatilla Electric serves 13,500 people approximately. Oregon Trail serves almost 30,000 customers. They both have approximately the same number of employees, and they both serve a whole lot of lines. You know, Pacific Corps, I'm glad Pacific Corps says that they are the provider in a lot of Eastern Oregon and a lot of Central Oregon, and that is true. Only they provide the power to the cities. We provide the power to the sagebrush. That is how it works out there in Eastern Oregon. And these two utilities, there's not anything different about these utilities whatsoever. There was a question asked the other day of how we got to 1.5%. And there was a comment made that because Oregon Trail had some different circumstances, and I'm here to tell you that there are no different circumstances for Oregon Trail. Oregon Trail was under a very expensive PURPA contract that was government mandated since the 1970s, and according to information that I got from Oregon Trail this morning, in this period of time, the customers of Oregon Trail Electric Co-op have paid $130 million more for power with that PURPA contract than they would have without the PURPA contract. That PURPA contract is now over, fortunately. So there are no different circumstances among those two utilities. All we have done is decided that we would pick and choose among consumer-owned utilities. And I refer back to the policy of the state, and that is that we treat consumer-owned utilities as a group of utilities, and we recognize that they are different than investor-owned utilities. So that concludes my comments. So we are asking you to support a minimum of a 3% contract or exemption from this mandate, and let consumers of consumer-owned utilities decide their power needs, and they've done a pretty darn good job doing it so far. And let these folks who are elected officials, elected by their constituents to represent them, continue to be able to do that job just as you like to do the job that you've been elected to do.
Thank you, Cindy. Appreciate it. Go ahead.
Madam Chair, representatives, thank you for the opportunity to speak in support of Senate Bill 838. For the record, my name is Paul Wooden. I'm executive director of a new Chapter 190 intergovernmental nonprofit organization, Community Renewable Energy Association. We represent a number of Oregon counties, community colleges, and small businesses who are involved in promoting policy for locally owned renewable projects in Oregon. One of the handouts you have in front of you is a map of Oregon showing a number of the community projects that are currently under development in the state, and it spans probably most of your districts from the wave energy on the coast to the geothermal and solar and small wind projects in Lake County and Klamath to the small wind projects and small hydro and biomass in Eastern Oregon, to all the activity taking place in the mid-Columbia in small hydro, small wind, and biomass, and the solar and geo and bio in Central Oregon. There's a lot of activity there. And we, as an organization, we're part of the Renewable Energy Working Group and help shape some of the language that makes sure that in the state of Oregon there is a place for these smaller projects. So we look forward to this bill.
Great, thank you.
I've got a few more things.
Okay, I've got about a minute, so
okay.
I'm sorry, I took advantage of the pause.
I want to talk a little bit about some of the issues that I have heard and some of the concerns I've heard about this bill, and I want to share a little bit of personal experience. I'm a businessman, and at one part of my life I worked in the aluminum world as chief engineer and plant manager and technical manager in a number of plants around the country. We were part of what happened about 5 years ago where the power rates in the Northwest rose to the point that 14 of us went out of business. 38,000 people were put on the streets. And I learned a real hard economic fact. There ain't no price cap on the power market in America. The fact that there is a 4% price cap on this bill is really interesting because there's no price cap on the double-digit inflation we've been seeing in natural gas prices. There's no price cap on the cost of the permitting, carbon caps, transportation costs in the coal industry. So when I hear people trying to argue or discuss the nuances of a 4% price cap, I somehow think we're all missing the point. We'd all be better off with price caps on as many pieces of the energy market as we can have. So I support the bill. I think it's a good one, and I think that it is not going to dramatically increase the cost of power in the state of Oregon. I have one final handout I submitted to you, and it's a little bit lengthy for those who like to look at graphs and bar charts and read things. It's a report from Lawrence Berkeley National Laboratory that have looked at the 21 states that have renewable portfolio standards in it and have tried to project out the projected costs of what these are costing in the United States. And basically, you know, with the exception of a state or two, they believe that the impact is around 1%. The cost cap was there because people asked us to put it in to make sure there wasn't any runaway clauses in the Senate Bill 838. The expectation is we'll never come close to it. So as you're considering all of the issues, consider the real power market out there and realize that we're in a tremendous period of dynamic flux right now. And this is just one piece that actually in many states has helped hold the cost down. Thank you.
Great. Thank you very much. Appreciate your comments.
Very quickly, Madam Chair.
Good question.
And maybe as they're going down, I could just share this. I want to share with the committee. You can hear the commitment that Sandy has to the amendment that she wants to propose. And I'll tell you what, I've been here four terms, and one thing I'll never understand, committee, is the lack of camaraderie we don't have, the lack of camaraderie we share when it comes to dealing with issues in a member's individual district. And what I want to share with you is this legislation that's before us is going to significantly benefit and affect my district, Representative Jensen's district, Representative Downs' district. And in my 4 years here, I have taken votes for members because they had important issues in their district that were important to them. Multnomah County Gang Enforcement Task Force money, as a member of Ways and Means. Not in a million years would I have felt comfortable voting for that. As chair of the Ways and Means Subcommittee on Transportation, voting to put $1 million into Washington County Rail, voting to do Amtrak funding from Marion County up to Multnomah County. And yet, whenever rural Oregon comes forward and says, can you help us on an issue to help one of our partners, the answer is always no. And I'm not trying to make you feel guilty. I guess I am venting, but I'll never understand the lack of camaraderie when these issues directly affect a member's district, why we don't step up and try and play a greater role to reach a compromise that works for not only the state, but for the member's district who's going to be directly impacted. And so I share that with you. And the reason I raise that issue is because Oregon Trail Electric and Umatilla Electric Co-op are both right there in the heart of my district and Representative Jensen's district. And we're trying to get to a position where we can support this legislation, but we can't figure out how to get to a compromise that works for all of us. So I just share that with you.
Thank you, Representative Smith. Appreciate your comments. Thank you, panel.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, if I could just very quickly.
I have two more panels before we get kicked out of here at 3 o'clock.
We'll get it done. Paul and Don, sorry, it's been a long day. We've had some conversations the last couple of days, and I very much appreciate you guys taking the time to visit with me. And one of the things that I've asked the Department of Energy to follow up on is this question about the hydro, because it's really not to me, when I read the bill over and over and over again, I'm still a little bit confused about exactly where and how. And for example, the irrigation districts in my district, which pull their water out of the Deschutes River is protected under the State Wild and Scenic Rivers Act. So I'm asking a question, if they put in a small hydro project, does that really qualify? And I think we had the same question. So I just wanted to let you know we are following up on that, and I think we need to make sure that we're all okay on that, because I know one of your PUDs has got that hydro up in Idaho that you're very concerned about. Thank you very much.
Thank you. And we did pass the small hydro bill out of here.
Yes, thank you.
And that's going to the House floor. I think after it goes to, I don't think it has Ways and Means. Okay, next panel is Tom O'Connor, Troy Gagliano, and Jason Hauser?
Huser.
I always get that wrong. Okay, and then after that we'll have the folks that couldn't come back on Friday, and everybody else will have back on Friday. Thank you, gentlemen. Tom, why don't you get started?
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, my name is Tom O'Connor. I represent Oregon Municipal Electric Utilities Association. OMEU members are primarily small nonprofit distribution utilities, pardon the glasses, who buy our power from BPA under long-term federal contracts. We are governed by our local elected city councils and utility boards. Last year, OMEU adopted a resolution describing our principles for consideration of an Oregon Renewable Portfolio Standard. The resolution said that we support the use of goals rather than mandates. But if there was going to be a state policy mandate, it should be based on the following principles. Since that time, we have worked over the last year and a half with the governor's office, our local legislators, and the proponents of the Oregon RPS. We took these principles into our discussions and negotiations. We didn't get everything we wanted, but on balance, we believe that SB 838 meets the test of our principles. We support Senate Bill 838 and Gross. Here's how we came to that conclusion. Our first principle was that the RPS must not cause a reduction in our share of federal preference power from BPA, which, as has been mentioned, is virtually 100% greenhouse gas free. The bill under in Section 8.3 states that a municipal utility may reduce its RPS obligation in order to avoid a reduction in our lowest cost BPA power. There is also similar language for our low-cost hydro contracts with the Mid-Columbia PUD projects that are mentioned in Section 8, Sub 2. Our second principle was that the targets should focus on load growth. The targets in the bill are on total load, but if by exempting Bonneville Tier 1 and the Mid-Sea contracts, you accomplish, at least in our mind, much the same thing. Section 8.1b, in addition, states that a utility may reduce its target obligation to the extent that the RPS would require it or might require it to displace non-fossil fuel electricity. Again, focusing more of the attention on load growth. Our third principle was that local elected officials must retain the flexibility to determine the most effective mix of renewables and conservation needed to meet the targets. In the bill, very important to us, there are no hard carve-outs or special mandates for specific resources. The utility may use alternative compliance payments to fund local conservation projects. There is a robust list of eligible renewable resources, including cogen, new hydro, upgrades to existing hydro, including upgrades to the BPA and the Mid-Sea facilities. Our fourth principle was that the RPS should avoid new regulation or what we called micromanagement by either ODO or PUC. The bill, we feel, accomplishes that. There are alternative compliance payments that are used for us rather than penalties. Our governing boards are in charge of reviewing compliance and providing reports to our customers. The governing boards set the level of ACP payments. The local governing boards determine the utility's revenue requirement and determine the incremental cost of new resources compared to a new non-renewable resource for application of the cost cap. Our fifth principle was that the target should be reasonable, flexible, and meaningful, and should include off-ramps to avoid economic harm to our customers. The targets in the out years, in particular, are very aggressive. And our ability to meet those out-year targets will depend greatly on the region's cooperative effort to secure adequate transmission, the availability of the Columbia River hydro system, and additional fossil fuel sources to shape and firm variable resources like wind. And finally, most important for small utilities, the availability of a Tier 2 renewable resource from Bonneville.
I need to have you wrap up because we have 5 minutes left for six
okay.
people.
I'll wrap up by saying that, in conclusion, we believe Senate Bill 838, on balance, meets the test of the principles that we adopted. I do want to say, though, that it's important, I think, that you recognize that implementing this renewable resource standard will not be an easy task. Our customers tell us they want renewables. They also tell us they want safe, low-cost power. We're going to start new contracts with Bonneville in 2011. We'll be responsible for meeting our load growth. A lot of what we do is going to be dependent on the continued viability of the Columbia River hydro system. The question now for us is, what do we do in the future? We think that this bill starts us in the right direction. Those targets, as I mentioned, are extremely aggressive in the out years, but we do feel it's important to get started now. If we don't get started now, the cost of future efforts required to deal with the effects of carbon and climate change will be even greater. We feel that this legislation puts us on the path most Oregonians want, and we support it.
Thank you, Tom. You guys got 2 minutes. I hate to tell you, Tom used up your extra, so. And we have a senator who wants to quickly say a few minutes, and we have two people who can't come back on Friday.
I'll be brief.
Okay.
Chair Dingfelder, members of the committee, thanks for the opportunity to testify for the record. My name is Jason Huser, Legislative Affairs Manager for Eugene Water and Electric Board. We're here today in support of SB 838A engrossed. We also support OMEU's principles as they apply to the bill. I'll just summarize real quickly by pointing out that EWEB is Oregon's largest consumer-owned utility with 83,000 customers. We've gone down a renewables and conservation road dating back to the late 1980s. I would say we're probably as renewable as any comparable sized utility in the West Coast, probably the country. Nonetheless, we did have trepidation at the outset of the RPS debate 6 months ago. I guess you could say, as a utility that had gone down that road already, we were concerned about getting credit for these past investments. To borrow a baseball metaphor, we didn't want to start off on third base and only get a quarter of a run when we got to home plate. I'm heartened to tell you that today the bill as written has addressed the concerns that we've had. We think it's a workable bill, and we're supporting Senate Bill 838A.
Great. Thank you. Jason, appreciate it.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Troy Gagliano. Can you hear me? Troy Gagliano with the Renewable Northwest Project.
Actually, it's better if you're a little further.
There we are. Sorry. Renewable Northwest Project is a renewable advocacy group. We support the development of wind, solar, and geothermal in the four northwestern states. We were a member of the Renewable Energy Working Group that has formulated the RPS. Two quick things I'll say. We've heard a lot about details today, and I'd like to bring you up a few thousand feet. A lot of things you've heard today, especially about cost cap, assume a lot of the worst-case scenarios, and they assume that renewables cost more money. Utilities across the country, Puget Sound in Washington, Xcel in Colorado, are reporting savings from their investments in wind energy. We have 21 other states with this policy, and nowhere in any case is the sky falling or are rates being increased in any significant way. The question was, we want proof for that a cost cap would work. I would encourage you to search for proof to where renewables and wind energy investments are raising investments. The final thing, and I handed out a brief on the flexibility that's in there for the consumer-owned utilities. Tom and Jason have addressed that. The other thing I'll just ask you to, I'll finish with, is to ask you to think about the wide variety of interest you've heard from in the last couple of days, and also in the Senate. We've heard from the PUC itself, from ratepayer advocates, IOUs and munis, from judges, sheriffs, and county commissioners across the state. There is no issue like this that brings this many people together. All these folks are rarely on the same side, but they are saying yes for 838 because it's well vetted. It represents a lot of negotiation and good faith, and that's the purpose of the legislative process, and this bill is evidence of that. So thank you for your time.
Great, thank you. Any quick questions for this panel? Thank you, gentlemen. Appreciate it. I'm going to bring up, actually, Senator Ferrioli wants to say a few words, and then we have two people who cannot come back on Friday, and that is Walt McKeskey and I think it was Alan. Why don't you all come up?
Thank you, Madam Chair, and members of the committee. I likewise will be not able to be here Friday, or I would defer testimony till that point. We're taking the Rural Communities Roadshow out to talk about the loss of timber dollars to local communities. Madam Chair, I have brought you an amendment to 838, and if I might, Senator Ted Ferrioli, for the record, just simply familiarize committee members with what the amendment would do. In describing the action of Senate Bill 838, a date was inserted of in 1995, before which none of the facilities that are currently engaged in alternative energy and green power production would be included. And as we've drilled into that issue, what we've learned is the date really was an arbitrary selection. There is no science, there is no real policy reason for the date. It was simply a question of deciding that you have to draw the line somewhere. And Madam Chair and members of the committee, that strands about 10 of the forest products early adopters who were using biomass to create electricity as early as the turn of the century. 1938, we had one in Gilcrest that was operating on wood waste and producing green power capturing value and energy from a commodity that normally had just been burnt and put carbon in the air. Madam Chair, this group of people are early adopters. We should find some way to reward the fact that these are pioneers in green power. The date puts them at a disadvantage because they will not be able to participate in the subsidy or the tax credits that will be offered to other producers of green power. So, Madam Chair, I've tried to describe a very, very specific amendment to the bill. I'll leave copies with the committee administrator that would simply say that if a facility for the purpose of complying with the renewable portfolio standard was established and was operational before January 1995, it was located in Oregon, it generates electricity solely from the combustion of solid organic wood products that have not been treated with chemical preservatives, including creosote, pentachlorine, chromated copper, arsenate, or others, and is connected already to the transmission system of a member of the Western Electricity Coordinating Council, then it would, in fact, be eligible for the benefits that are being conferred by Senate Bill 838. Madam Chair, we think that it is a very small amendment. It affects a relatively few megawatts, but it does prevent the creation of winners and losers in our attempt to grow the renewable portfolio. So if I may, Madam Chair, that is the sum total of my testimony. I very much appreciate the opportunity to put it on the record, and I will leave the documents with the committee administrator.
Thank you, Senator, and I apologize for the rush. We have we're being circled right now by the next committee, so if you gentlemen could just take a few seconds each to get you on the record, and then we'll close the hearing for today.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Walt McKesky. I cannot come back on Friday because we're having an engagement party for our younger son and his fiance. I am a registered engineer in water and wastewater in the state of Oregon and Idaho. I just want to make 3 points briefly here to you today. I come as a volunteer. First is, technologically, renewables work. This piece of legislation, 833, is needed to put the policy in place to make it happen. We engineers need the mandate from the public. Secondly, in terms of ratepayers, I was hoping that Representative Smith would still be here. I am a PGE customer. I have been participating in the renewable power program since its beginning. PGE has just offered a new program, Renewable Wind, where they guarantee the rate to 2012, and I pay just 3% more today. That's 3/10 of a kilowatt, 3/10 of a cent more per kilowatt hour today, but they give me a guaranteed rate for the next 5 years. I think they did that because we've supported renewable power, and this is something that they have done without any influence that I can tell from the PUC or any mandates. Finally, I just want to say, in terms of wastewater treatment, the public is demanding more and more that we provide cleaner and cleaner water and wastewater. To do that requires electrical energy. We can't afford to be taking pollution out of water and putting it into the air by using dirty sources of energy. We need renewables to clean up our water. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Walt. Appreciate your comments.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Thanks for the opportunity to testify for the record. My name is Alan Hickenbottom. I'm the Northwest Director for Grow Solar. I'll forego my testimony. I did want to address a couple things that came up and bring them back to ground. One was that Ms. Blicker, who I think represents her constituency very well and with a lot of passion, and I have a lot of respect for her, but made a comment about that there currently are no emissions from public power. Well, that's about to change. I know that at least one PUD in the state, and probably others that I can specifically speak of, is about to ask their members to invest in pulverized coal, which is about as dirty a power source as we can get. So the public power's very laudable record is about to be cut short. The reason that power is available is because states like California, Washington, and Oregon's own PUC have eliminated the ability for these utilities to invest in coal in the efforts for global greenhouse gas reduction and renewables promotion. So that's why that coal is available. What this shows is if we do not get an RPS here, an RES here, that we will be left holding the bag as far as these lesser resources. The other one I will try and catch up with Representative Burley. I had some ETO comments that he would probably appreciate.
All right, great. Thank you, gentlemen. I apologize about the rush. Before I close this public hearing, I just want to state for the record that we will carry the public hearing over on Friday for folks who couldn't testify, so we will have the public hearing posted as soon as we leave this room for Friday as well, and that's for the remainder of the folks who could not be, I was not able to fit in today, and I apologize about the rush, but we have a lot more folks than we anticipated. With that, I will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 838, and just a reminder to the remaining committee members that we have a hearing tonight, informational hearing from 6:30 to 8 p.m. on climate change. So we'll be back in this room.